Hello and welcome to At Home This Morning, our magazine programme for older listeners, which we hope will also be of interest to the not so old. I'm Richard Davis, and I hope you'll stay with me for the next hour. Coming up in that time, we'll be hearing about a proposed extension to the Rampion Wind Farm. Then we'll be finding out about a new scheme set up by a charity called the Shaw Trust, which aims to help people get back into work following the pandemic. We'll be hearing about a website that's been set up by Public Health England to help people with mental health problems that may have been caused by the pandemic. And to finish off with, we'll be talking to the founder and organiser of the Women Over 50 Film Festival to find out what they're doing this year. As usual, we'll be giving out various email addresses, website addresses and telephone numbers during the course of the programme. So you may like to have a pencil and paper handy so that you can write them down. Anyway, let's get started by hearing about the Rampion Wind Farm. As I said before, the company behind it are proposing to add quite a few extra turbines to it to improve its capacity. And they're holding an online public consultation about it at this very moment. To find out more, Chris English went to talk to Chris Tomlinson of the Rampion organisation, and he began by asking why an extension is necessary.
Well, first of all, I suppose we should start with the climate change imperative. The United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change has a whole number of climate scientists from all around the world, and basically we've got until the end of this decade to keep warming below 1.5 degrees above pre-industrial levels. And beyond that, obviously, we get into the sort of catastrophic and irreversible consequences of climate change. So it's right that we try and do more. You might ask the question, of course, well, why here again? Well, we have a UK government target to quadruple the capacity of electricity generated from offshore wind by the end of this decade. Now, you may be surprised to learn we already generate 20% of our electricity from wind energy, half of that from onshore wind, half from offshore wind. And offshore wind's contribution is made from 40 offshore wind farms around the UK. Yet only one of those 40 offshore wind farms is on the south coast of England, and that is Rampion. And of course, we are a hugely densely populated region in Europe, one of the most populated areas in Europe, and therefore we have a very high electricity demand centre. So it's right that we do more in this part of the world.
As I said, we've grown used to it out there, 12 miles off Brighton. Where will the second part go?
Yeah, so it's 8 miles offshore at the nearest point. And in terms of where we'll go, what we're looking at the moment is an area of search. So it's quite a large area that you will see when you visit rampion2.com and have a look at our virtual exhibition. Please do that. We'd really value your feedback. It looks like a large area. We won't be putting wind turbines all over this area. We want to have one more shot at this, really, one more go at this. So we want to find the optimum site for a wind farm somewhere within that area of search. And of course, we have to consider a large amount of issues. We have to carry out a number of environmental and ecological surveys, a number of technical and engineering surveys, looking at things like seabed geology, water depth, marine mammals, birds, you name it, we have to carry out a survey. And of course, we have been engaging for a number of months now with the likes of Natural England, the Marine Management Organisation, local ports and so on, lots of statutory consultees. And now we're at the point, of course, we're going out to the wider community with our virtual exhibition at rampion2.com. And all that feedback will go into a pot with the survey results to make sure we can find the best, least impact site for the wind farm somewhere within that wider area of search.
Now, I've been looking at your virtual exhibition, and very good it is too. And we'll get you to give us the web address again a bit later on. But it's a fairly huge area. But what you're saying is that it's not all going to be filled with turbines.
No, absolutely not. As I say, we want one more shot at this. What we're doing is we're reinvestigating an area just to the east and the south of the existing wind farm that was actually in the original zone that we were exploring 10 years ago. But technology has moved on. Back then, the water depths were such that it would have been impossible pretty much to have installation vessels operate there. And turbine technology has moved on such that monopile foundations that one piles into the seabed wouldn't have been possible in those deeper waters when we were looking at Rampion for the first time around. Now we can look at that again. Also, to the west was an area we didn't explore first time around because it had some aggregates licenses on there. So that meant that some aggregates companies already had agreements with the Crown Estate, the landlord of the seabed, so that it wasn't possible for us to go into that area. Those licenses have come to an end, so that area is now available for us to explore. But again, just to emphasise, this is an area of search. There won't be turbines covering this entire area, but let's have one more look at the whole thing and find the best place for a wind farm somewhere within that larger area of search.
Will it connect electrically to the existing cabling coming ashore to go to the substation at Bolney?
Not the same cables. I mean, at the time when we were investing back in 2015, there was no prospect at that time of this new leasing round from the Crown Estate. They've actually invited operators of existing offshore wind farms to look at potential extensions to those wind farms. That wasn't known until 2018. And of course, also the industry regulator, it requires every project to be designed and invested in an economic and efficient manner to minimise cost to the end consumer. So this prevented us from building in any sort of speculative or spare capacity. So the cables for the original Rampion project were therefore rated at a maximum capacity of 400 megawatts because that is the capacity of the existing Rampion wind farm. So we couldn't future-proof. So we need new electrical infrastructure to carry the new power from Rampion to the national grid.
Obviously, it's too early to know where that route will go. But what do you say to the detractors for wind power that say it's inefficient, it doesn't work?
In terms of the detractors, first of all, it absolutely does work. As I said earlier, it might surprise you to learn that we're now generating 20%. This is averaged over the course of the year, 20% of the UK's electricity from wind energy alone. We are the leading renewable energy technology. On a particularly windy day, it might be 40 or 50% of the UK's electricity generated from wind power. Now, I started in this industry not 20 years ago, and we were generating 0.2% of the UK's electricity. So that's been a 100-fold increase already in less than 20 years. And now in the next 10 years, we're looking at quadrupling the amount of offshore wind again. Offshore wind has some advantages over onshore wind. I fully respect those who don't like the appearance of wind turbines. I have to say it is a minority, but I do fully accept that because beauty is in the eye of the beholder. We don't all like the same piece of art. We don't all like the same piece of architecture. Wouldn't the world be boring if we did? But what I've noticed in the 20 years I've been in the industry is that those people who tend not to like the appearance of wind turbines, whereas 20 years ago they might have then objected, they tend to be now realising the bigger picture. There are far more important things that we have to concern ourselves about if we're going to look after this planet for our children and our grandchildren to live on. So I'm seeing that. And the evidence is actually, we carried out a study back in 2010. An independent polling organisation called Populus surveyed the Sussex community and found that 80% of people supported, felt positive towards the prospect of a wind farm. This is back in 2010. Now, after the wind farm had been up on the horizon for 2 years or more, we carried out the same study. And I'm pleased to say that actually that figure has risen from 80 to 85% in support of the Rampion scheme. And actually only 4% of people in Sussex feel negative towards the Rampion scheme. So there is a lot of positivity to it. But I do fully appreciate that the beauty is in the eye of the beholder.
This is an informal consultation. So what should our listeners do if they want to find out more?
Thanks for raising that. Yeah, this is the first. This is actually a voluntary consultation. It's the first of a two-part consultation. So with the Rampion scheme, we had one phase of consultation. This time we're doing it twice. Obviously, we're working in difficult times. We'd love to meet everyone face to face, but obviously we can't at the moment. So this is really about raising awareness of the area of search and giving us an indication of any issues you think we should be taking into account within those areas of search, anything you think we might have missed. So that might be the offshore area of search for the wind farm or the area of search for the offshore export cables or for the onshore cables and up at the substation where we need to connect the power to the national transmission grid near Bolney. We have three search areas for a new substation. What are the pros and cons of those search areas? And where within those search areas do you think is the right place for the permanent substation equipment? Now, you can look at all these issues, all these areas of search and all the work we're doing at rampion2.com, where we've set up, you just have to click enter the exhibition and you can go into our virtual village hall. So while we can't see you face to face, you can see a virtual exhibition, you can see videos, fly over our indicative cable route and various route options that we still have available and see what we've got in play. And then the most important thing, of course, is to feedback your comments. So please do look at the feedback form. It doesn't take more than 5 or 10 minutes to fill it out and do submit those comments. And we will take all that into account as we seek to further refine the proposals. But of course, 24 hours a day, it's online, anytime that suits you. Get a cup of coffee or a beer, if you like, and go and have a look at the exhibition in your own time and submit your feedback. And as I say, this is the first opportunity to make your voice heard. There will be, what we'll do then is we'll refine our proposals in the spring and we'll come back in May, June, July for a second more formal consultation exercise. So there'll be more flesh on the bones, a more defined onshore cable route, possibly a reduction in the area of searches. More information about how we construct the wind farm and how we mitigate and minimise impacts on the environment and communities. And we'll be looking at much more detailed feedback second time around. But please do go to rampion2.com, have a look around the exhibition and let us have your feedback.
Chris English was talking to Chris Tomlinson about the proposed extension to the Rampion Wind Farm, a project which is known as Rampion 2. There's an online consultation running at the moment. And to take part, you need to go to the website rampion2.com. And on that website, you can find out all the information you need. However, the consultation closes fairly soon, on February the 11th, in fact. So you need to get your opinion in quickly. Well, now, as we all know, the COVID pandemic has had a major impact on employment, with many people being furloughed from their jobs, or indeed finding that the job has disappeared altogether and they have to search for a new one. This can be particularly bad for older people who perhaps have been in work all their lives and are now out of work for the first time, and the process can lead to a sense of low self-belief. Well, a charity known as the Shaw Trust has been dedicated for many years to helping out in this sort of situation, and it's recently started a partnership with an international recruitment agency known as Indeed. To find out more, I spoke to Chris Luck, who's the CEO of the Shaw Trust, and to Renata Graver, their chief of staff. And I began by asking Chris to explain who the Shaw Trust are.
Shaw Trust is a charity that supports both young people and adults into employment, especially those with complex needs. And we do this by having a career support wraparound to help improve their chances, but also their chances in life going forward. And we do this using a sort of a child to career framework. So we don't just look up employment, but we also go back all the way to schools, multi-academy trusts, children's homes. But the aim of it is to get people, despite hurdles, trials, tribulations, into good employment. And I think in a nutshell, that is Shaw Trust.
And you started off some years ago helping disabled people to find work, didn't you?
Well, that's right, actually, yes. 30 years ago in Shaw, in Wiltshire, hence the name Shaw Trust.
OK, now, can I ask you, are Indeed connected with you or are they a separate organisation?
Indeed is a separate organisation. They're the world's number one job site, but we absolutely share mutual aims of getting people into work, and we share values. So we've joined together in a partnership to bring their unique skills and our unique skills together to give more opportunities to enhance people's pathway into work. So that's what this partnership is about.
And they run a website which is to enable people to connect up with employers.
Absolutely. I mean, they've got the world, literally the world's number one website, with over a quarter of a billion visitors every month. They've got a wonderful connectivity with the all the employers out there. Importantly, they do a lot of research into what helps people get into work, because their mission is to succeed. So they really put a lot of research into that. We like what they've got. They like how we approach employability. So we've come together to try and really crank up the our ability to help people into work in these very difficult times.
And they've recently run a survey of how COVID is affecting people's ability to find work. What did they find out?
Well, I think the key thing at this moment in time that affects people's ability to get into work is actually about confidence. You know, when it comes to individuals, our work gives us our identity and it gives us meaning. And I think COVID has been so savage in its effect on employment that a lot of people have lost confidence. You know, they've lost the comfort, the security of their routine. And also some of those traditional areas where people start work, you know, certainly the young, such as hospitality and retail, I mean, they've been devastated. Those sectors will come back, but just not yet. So being able to cope with the shock, if you like, of sudden unemployment, the what appears to be a limited opportunity, and then potentially changing job, changing sector, those really impact on confidence, which is why we've partnered with Indeed and why Renata Graeber, my chief of staff, has become a confidence ambassador to help signpost people and to give them opportunity to realize that actually they've got really cracking skills and really great skills. If you're in retail or you were in retail and hospitality, you know, your people skills, your ability to think on your feet and to act under pressure, those are genuine skills that can be repackaged. And with Indeed, what they've done is they've put a lot of digital help programs, a series of free online skills workshops for those that connect with us or with them to use to help them get, you know, really get after new jobs in new sectors and to have the confidence to do so.
Now, this radio program At Home This Morning is designed to appeal particularly to older people, and I should imagine that the situation in terms of lack of confidence is particularly bad for people who perhaps are in their 50s or even 60s and have been in work all their lives, and now they're out of work and wondering if they'll ever manage to find another job.
You're absolutely right, Richard. And certainly the research and, you know, what's obvious in front of us is that, you know, one of the groups that's been heavily impacted by COVID are the over 50s. So you're absolutely right to point out that the over 50s are extraordinarily challenged as well, as much as the under 25s.
And the paradox is possibly that having worked for all those years, they have more developed skills than the younger people.
Yes, I think, you know, by the time somebody's 50, they've got a unique set of skills and experience to connect to those skills. And invariably, they're sort of in... they could be in management and leadership roles because of their experience. But that's a plus. And they can take that to new sectors, new work, new jobs. And it's for sure trust with its partners, such as Indeed, to really open up the world of opportunity for those over 50 with their skills and point them to and connect them to those new opportunities. So there's a lot out there, but it's knowing how to prepare yourself and how to connect and how to make sense of it. And I think that's what Shore Trust does. And with our partner Indeed, I think we can really get after that at pace.
So this is a new project that you and Indeed have established to help to deal with this situation, and it involves the appointment of a confidence ambassador who's one of your colleagues from the Shore Trust, Renata Graeber. So, Renata, this must be a new departure for you, as you've had various other jobs within the organisation before.
Yeah, but as a confidence ambassador, I think it's important to understand the resilience and building up that people require. It is a very, very challenging time. And it's also important to remember that behind every job seeker, everyone who's unemployed, everyone facing a challenge, is an actual human being who requires a tailored approach and who also has a family behind them, children maybe who are reliant on them, to keeping that human factor in mind. But that we are here to help. Indeed, Sure Trust, there are people out here who are willing to help and want to help.
So what does your new role involve?
So within my new role, I will be supporting with some Facebook Live workshops with Indeed, and we'll be looking at confidence, resilience, and also the toolkit that people require to begin job searching again, and also to look at resilience itself and how that sits within people's lives. So building a routine, making sure that people are still getting up in the morning at a reasonable time, and their approach to job searching almost as a job in itself.
And are these interactive workshops?
Yes, they will be interactive, and there will be a chance for people to come back, ask questions, and obviously join the following workshops that are to come.
So presumably you're running them on a regular basis, are you?
Yeah, they'll be run on a regular basis. We're starting off with four, and they'll be run across the coming months. And then hopefully there will be other things out there as well.
How do people actually make contact with Indeed in the first place?
For this particular opportunity, go to their Facebook site, and the address for that is @IndeedUKIE, all as one word.
Okay, and from there you can progress to any other part of the website that you need.
That's right. The connectivity into the programme is signposted from there. But if there's any difficulty or doubt, then by all means, come back to us at the Sure Trust website and email in, and we'll help sort out whoever needs extra bit of guidance to get through.
And the Sure Trust website is what?
SureTrust.org.uk.
It sounds like a very useful project, and hopefully very encouraging for people who are having difficulty finding jobs post-COVID, especially older people. Chris Luck and Renata Graver, thanks very much.
Thank you, Richard.
I was talking to Chris Luck and Renata Graver of the Sure Trust. If you'd like to find out more about their partnership with Indeed, you can go to their website, which is suretrust.org.uk. That's suretrust.org.uk. And sure in that is spelt S-H-A-W. Well, it's not just job seekers, who we heard about in the last interview, whose mental health is being adversely affected by the current pandemic. To find out more about this, Public Health England has recently run a survey, the results of which have just been published. And following on from that, they've set up a website giving advice on how people can improve their mental health. To find out more, I spoke via Zoom to NHS psychiatrist Dr. Max Pemberton, and I began by asking him what the aim of the survey was.
It was to look at the impact that lockdown's been having on people's mental health. And this latest survey showed that when you compare this current lockdown to the first one, that about 50% of people are reporting that they feel more worried, more anxious, and more stressed than they did back in March.
Yes, I suppose that's understandable, because in March we thought it wasn't going to last very long, and indeed it seemed to go off during the summer, but it's come back again.
Yes, I think people are feeling really kind of despondent and a bit sort of fed up and feeling quite desperate. Of course, lots of people have had even longer now being on their own, have, you know, being more and more isolated, etc., etc.
Was there any difference between different age groups and genders?
So it's interesting, actually, as well as working in the media, I also work clinically as a doctor. And I would say that the lockdown has affected different groups in different ways. No group has sort of come out of this unscathed. So I've been very worried about children and the impact this has had on youngsters. and particularly with the disruption of their schooling. But then equally, older students found themselves to be suddenly quite isolated. They're not able to go back and see their family. And then working age adults have also had, you know, kind of all the difficulties of a disruption in their working patterns, being furloughed, potentially losing their jobs. And then, of course, older people have not only had the risk of the actual virus, but also there's the issue of loneliness and isolation.
Yes. Now, this programme is directed mainly towards older people. So what sort of advice would you be able to give them?
I suppose one of the key things that I think has affected the older generation is this isolation and loneliness. And we know that people are managing for the first couple of weeks, even the first couple of months. But now many of them have had to go for months and months and months without seeing people. There are a lot of resources, though, to try and support people. And actually, part of this campaign from Public Health England is about trying to make sure that people are aware of the resources that are available. So there's a whole host of things about befriending services, kind of your local support networks that you can access via their website.
Yes, I looked at some of the web links that were in the press release that you sent out, and there almost seems to be too much information out there. It's rather confusing as to know which organisation to ask about your condition.
Yeah, so I think that's a really good point. So I suppose the first thing is that this particular campaign, Every Mind Matters, is really looking at kind of tools and kind of strategies that all of us can use to try and help our mental health and improve our mental well-being, rather than actually addressing specific mental illness in any way. So I would sort of suggest to people to start off by sort of looking at the tips and techniques and tools and stuff that are being recommended on the website. And because we're all in different circumstances and have different situations, it's designed in such a way that you can go on and look and pull together the kind of key tips and advice and stuff that's relevant for you and that you would find helpful to develop what they're calling like a mind plan. So this kind of like a, almost like a toolkit. So that if you do find yourself struggling a bit, then you've got this kind of list of things that you know will be of benefit to you and sort of putting it together. And I think once you've done that, if you're still struggling and stuff, there are some specific services around, you know, addressing loneliness, and to then look at those.
And the website we're talking about is one operated by Public Health England, and it's called Better Health, Every Mind Matters. Is that right?
The actual website is everymindmatters.co.uk, or you can just search for Every Mind Matters and it comes up.
Okay, thanks. As you say, loneliness can be quite a problem. That's probably one of the major problems affecting older people, I would imagine.
Yes, absolutely. And that sense of isolation, we know that if we don't address it early on, it can then lead on to other mental health problems, things like low mood, and anxiety. And it's something I'm particularly worried about in the older generation, that actually they tend not to make a fuss. They tend not to push themselves forward. And the mental health services supporting older people tend to be underfunded. Historically, they have been. So I'm pleased to see that the government is making a real effort into trying to improve the funding for mental health services, including mental health services for older people. So I'd really encourage people to kind of, you know, reach out. Don't sit there suffering in silence. You're not alone. There's loads of services and loads of help out there.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Max.
Thank you so much, Richard. Thanks a lot.
I was talking to Dr. Max Pemberton about the Every Mind Matters campaign. The address of the website on which you can find all the information is www.nhs.uk/oneyou, that's O-N-E-Y-O-U, /every-mind-matters. I'll give you that address again. It's www.nhs.uk/oneyou/every-mind-matters. Well, despite the COVID pandemic, many arts events have managed to keep going, although some of them have had to change their format in order to fit in with the current regulations. One such is the annual Women Over 50 Film Festival, which started in a small way in Brighton a few years ago and has been growing ever since. Of course, it has had to change the way that it runs in order to keep going. To find out more, I spoke to its founder and organiser, Nulla O'Sullivan, and I began by asking her to explain what the festival is for the benefit of anyone who hasn't heard about it before.
Women Over 50 Film Festival, or WOF, is a celebration of the work of older women in film, in front of and behind the camera. So we're a short film festival. It takes place every September, and every film we show either has a woman over 50 at the heart of it on screen, really driving the action, or a woman over 50 as the writer, producer or director behind the camera. And what that gives us is a really welcoming, inclusive film festival, because you, Richard, could make a film, and as long as it's got an older woman at the heart of it, you and your film would be really welcome at WOF. And as an older woman, I could write a film about a 22-year-old boy, and that film and me would be welcome at WOF.
And how long's the festival been running for?
So we're coming into our seventh year, and as you know, we started in Brighton, and then we moved to the Depot Cinema in Lewes, and then last year, because of COVID, we had to move online. So as we go into our seventh year, we've got our fingers crossed that we'll be back at Depot. We've got our dates and we're booked in Depot, but we're also realistically thinking that we might have to go online again. So we'll wait and see and make a final decision on that, probably around April time.
You've been talking about the Depot. Can you just say what that is briefly?
Depot is a really beautiful, fairly new cinema in Lewes. And it's also super accessible. It's all on one floor, which is quite unusual for a cinema. So it's got great wheelchair access and great induction loops for people who are using hearing aids. So that's our usual festival home. It's super accessible for trains and buses and has great parking for bikes.
Yes, it is literally next door to Lewes Railway Station, isn't it?
It is, yes.
During the festival, you normally have screening sessions where people can come and view the various films. But as you say, COVID had put paid to that for the moment.
Yeah, I mean, being online, just as we are now in our conversation, you know, it's got its ups and downs. The ups for us being online last year were that so many more people around the world tuned in, and also filmmakers from Guatemala and Kenya and Georgia. So we had great participation from filmmakers and audiences. But of course, the downside is the whole thing of a festival is about bumping into people and making new friends and catching up with old ones and being part of a community in a physical space. You know, that we lost out on that.
Entries have already opened for this year's festival. How many have you had so far?
So we've got almost 50, I think, and we only opened at the beginning of January. I had a bit of an idea that submissions might be a bit down this year, numbers-wise, because, frankly, a lot of people weren't out and about being able to make films. And what we've seen so far, I think, is really interesting. A, submissions are about the same level as they were this time last year. And also what I'm seeing is people were making films the year before last and have spent lockdown editing and finalizing them. So that's one sort of film we're getting. And of course, the other sort we're getting are films that were made in lockdown. So quite a lot of use of two people on screen simultaneously, but clearly not in the same location. And we're getting some very interesting interpretations, particularly in dramas, of what people can do, even though the actors aren't in the same location. So filmmakers are being really creative about how they can keep making work in the middle of a pandemic.
Now, the main part of the festival occurs in September, and you're hoping, obviously, that the situation will have changed by then. You'll actually be able to put on live screenings in public places as before, but if, for some reason, the situation hasn't changed, what backup plans have you got?
Last year, when we went online, although we still had the same amount of material, we made the festival be 5 days because we thought that gave people a more realistic chance to move in and out of online. I mean, when you go to a festival, you pay your money and you say, I'm going to sit down, I'm going to watch films all day in the cinema. And that's just a wee bit more difficult when we're at home because our home life just interrupts us. So we wanted to give people more of a chance to dip in and out of the films and the filmmaker Q&As and so on. So we're committed to those two dates, the 25th and 26th in September at Depot. And then I think cinemas will probably be open in September. But as a festival, we have to make that decision about where we're going to be quite a bit earlier in the year. So if we make the decision in April, the situation might look quite different to how it is in September, but we're kind of committed to what we say in April. So if we do go online, how we did it last year, it was run from the house, and my wife, who works full time in another job, but who helps out a lot at WAF, she really came on board and we just ran it from the house. You know, home broadband is pretty good now. So we were able to, host all the films on an online platform that people could access. But the one thing that we didn't do, because I think it relies too heavily on a very good internet connection, was we didn't do any live events. We did, you know, conversations with filmmakers and so on, but we pre-recorded all of them. We know that we've got the home technology to be able to host an online festival if we have to go that way again this year.
Well, let's hope you don't have to use it anyway. In fact, some of the things you've had to put in place because of the current pandemic situation might actually be worth carrying on with even when things are back to normal, mightn't they?
Yeah, I absolutely agree. I think a hybrid approach is a really great idea, and I think it gives access to lots more people who maybe for distance reasons, for disability reasons, for money reasons, might not be able to come to a physical festival. I would really like to see a hybrid approach.
This year, you've got an additional award class, haven't you?
Yes, we do. So we have our regular prizes that we've had every year practically since we started. So we give a jury award for the best drama, best documentary, best animation, best experimental film. We also now have a best student award, and we have a best short script award. The new prize that we've got this year is in conjunction with Tenna, who many of your listeners might know, who make incontinence pads and pants. And Tenna, we've got an award called the Tenna Ageless Award. So they are funding a really big prize. So we have a first prize of £500, second prize of £300, and a third prize of £200. And that's big money for WAF prizes, when in our other categories, the prize winners are getting £75 and a bottle of gin. Any film that is put into WAF, if it meets some specific requirements, then automatically goes into the Tenna Award pot. And the Tenna category is if a film reflects the Tenna theme, which is our bodies age, but why should we? And what I love about that theme is it's very open to interpretation. And I think practically any WAF film, a filmmaker could argue that their film reflects the theme, our bodies age, but why should we? Those films will be judged by Tenna, and as well as that big prize money, 30-second clips of the film will be available for Tenna to use on their social media platform. So it's a real chance to have your film shown very widely, as well as being in the WAF Festival. Clips of it will be available worldwide as well.
Well, it sounds like an excellent idea. I hope they'll find it so successful that they'll carry it on in future years with you.
Oh, well, we would very much like that indeed. Yeah, they seem like a great partner. We're really enjoying working with them so far.
So, Nola, are you still accepting entries, or has entry closed for them?
Oh, no, entries have really only just opened. They opened at the beginning of January, and they're open until mid-July. And you have to pay a fee to submit your film. But we were really aware this year that budgets are tight for everyone. So what we have done is we've kept our submission fees the same as last year. There are also a couple of free options if people are finding money tight. So the first thing is we've had a student category, which we've had for quite a number of years. And although I know most students are young, there are certainly older people going back to college. So some of your listeners might be attending college or university. So it's always been free submissions for students. You just have to show us some identification, you know, your student ID pass or whatever. And then you don't have to pay the submission fee. And the other thing that we've offered since we began 7 years ago is a bursary to allow you to submit your work free of charge. And we usually offer around about 10 or 15 bursaries a year. So people just have to write to us. The details are on our website. And there's a short form that you have to fill out, and basically 100 words on, you know, why you need a bursary. We're particularly aiming at countries where it's more difficult for people to come up with dollars or pounds for a submission fee. But we've given submissions to people in the UK, in the USA, you know, so it's completely open to anybody if you need some help, because we're really committed to screening work from people all over the world, and we don't want there to be any barrier to you submitting work to us.
And all the details, as you say, are on the website.
That's right. Our website is wofff.co.uk, and we're on the usual social media platforms like Instagram, Facebook and Twitter. And there we're at wo50ff. That's wo50ff. If you want to send us an email about anything, you can email us at info@wofff.co.uk. And if you want to submit a film to us, the platform we're using is Film Freeway, and they're at filmfreeway.com. And if you go onto that website and then just search for Women Over 50 Film Festival, you'll come to our page. And that's where all the information, rules and regs and prizes for this year's WOF.
All very well organised, and I know it's a very successful festival, Noah, so let's hope that it goes suitably well this year. I'm sure it will. Thanks for talking to me.
OK, thanks for getting in contact.
I was talking to Nola O'Sullivan about this year's Women Over 50 Film Festival. If you'd like more information, you can go to their website, which is wofff.co.uk. Make sure you put in three Fs, that is W-O-F-F-F. On Facebook and Twitter, they're at WO50FF, and you can email them, and the email address is info@wofff.co.uk. And that brings us to the end of this week's programme. Thank you very much for listening. I hope you've enjoyed everything you've heard. There'll be another edition in a fortnight's time, and that'll be presented by Chris English. And I'll be back with you in 4 weeks. It only now remains for me, Richard Davis, on behalf of Grey Matters Productions, who make this programme for Radio Reverb, to thank everyone who's taken part, and to wish you, our listeners, all the very best until we meet again. Goodbye.